check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Before the 10,000 years of stable climate our civilization grew up in, the great glaciers came and went. The climate shifted with them, sometimes warming as much as 5 degrees centigrade within 50 years, we've been told by a recent guest. It's a tough field to understand, and harder still to figure out what applies to climate change today and what does not. Some climate deniers have played on that confusion. But the science of past deglaciation is getting better and better. A new paper out from a team of scientists from the United States, Britain, and New Zealand almost crushed my skull with problems. I wrote the lead author, Thomas K. Bosca, with my beginner's questions, and he patiently schooled me a bit in the patterns of climate change that I did not know. And that's why we've called on Thomas today. Educated in Chicago with a PhD in geology from Oregon State, Dr. Bosca is currently a researcher with the Department of Earth Sciences at the University of Cambridge in Britain. The paper that stimulated this discussion is titled Carbon Isotopes Characterize Rapid Changes in Atmospheric Carbon Dioxide During the Last Deglaciation. It was just published in the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, or PNAS. Thomas, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for letting me be here.
As a non-scientist, my first surprise reading your paper was that deglaciation can cause a rise in CO2 and not the other way around. Is that true, and how could that happen?
Yes, that's true. One way is through positive feedbacks in the climate system. And one simple example of that, of a positive feedback that we probably are seeing in the deglaciation, is that as the Earth warms, the temperature of the ocean will also increase. And warmer ocean waters can hold less CO2. And one way to think about that is just like when your soda pop gets warm, it will degas and feel a little bit less bubbly. So as the ocean warms, it will actually give off more CO2 into the atmosphere, thus increasing temperatures, which actually then creates a positive feedback loop where ocean temperatures increase once again and CO2 continues to rise.
About 10 years ago, people denied carbon dioxide was warming the planet. They jumped on the science of glaciology to produce the argument summarized as CO2 doesn't lead, it lags. Can carbon levels rise after a warming? And if so, what do you think caused the initial warming that you studied?
Yeah, the cause of the initial warming or the initial trigger for the CO2 rise is still a bit of an open question in the deglaciation. What we think we see when CO2 initially rises about 18,000 years ago is either a switch in ocean circulation or perhaps a switch in the strength of the biological pump in the ocean, essentially a decrease in how productive the oceans, and that released the initial CO2, which then sort of triggered the deglaciation.
And when you say productive, you may be talking about plankton, for example.
Yeah, exactly. When plankton produce carbon in the surface ocean, they eventually die and fall into the deep ocean where that carbon is respired. That carbon is built up in the deep ocean. If, for instance, you have essentially a big shift in ocean circulation, like upwelling of these carbon-rich waters to the surface, you'll get a rise in atmospheric CO2.
Now, talking about this, in email you referred me to a 2012 paper published in the journal Nature by Shakun et al., and the title is Global Warming Preceded by Increasing Carbon Dioxide Concentrations During the Last Deglaciation. What does that paper tell us?
That paper tells us, on the whole, looking at globally average temperatures, that the CO2 actually still increased first and drove probably quite a bit of the global warming during the last deglaciation. Now, a lot of other factors are at play, including shifts in the Earth's orbit that control how much sunlight, say, gets to the northern hemisphere, and will, at least at that time, 20,000 years ago when the ice sheets had covered most of Canada, that increasing solar radiation can melt the ice sheets. Because I think it's actually a really interesting point that Shakun brought up, because previously skeptics had called on this idea that temperature rose before CO2, and then therefore CO2 had no impact on the last deglaciation. But largely those arguments were based on the lead-lag relationship between temperature in Antarctica and CO2 in the ice cores that we measure in Antarctica. And there are a couple of factors going on there, but the simple one is that it's only really comparing one location, one place on the Earth to CO2. So what Shackin did was he compiled many, many records from both the Northern Hemisphere and some Southern Hemisphere, Greenland, Antarctica, the tropics, and added them all together to figure out globally that temperatures were actually lagging the CO2 rise.
Now, I'd like to shift a little bit in our topic here. Some scientists, in fact, a growing number, worry about the possibility of an abrupt climate shift. And I notice that many of the examples of such shifts given in the past occur during times of deglaciation. True?
That's true. During the deglaciation, and let's just frame it here, this is about 18,000 to 10,000 years in the past. On average, we saw global temperatures rise fairly slowly, maybe 3 or 4 degrees centigrade over that about 10,000 years. Now, some places saw abrupt climate change, and particularly this was documented from the Greenland ice cores, where about halfway through the deglaciation, let's say, at about 14,000 years ago, Greenland temperatures shot up over 10 degrees, probably. And at the same time, we saw a huge spike in the methane concentration and a small increase in CO2 by about 10 ppm over a few centuries. This is one of the intervals we addressed in our study.
When was that?
So that was the onset of the Bolling-Alerod period, which is about 14.6 thousand years ago.
And temperatures in Greenland went up about 10 degrees C in a pretty quick time. You said two abrupt climate changes were likely driven by changes in land carbon. What does that mean?
When we investigated a few of the times that CO2 was rising fairly rapidly, and when I say rapidly, that's rapid for a geologist. So we're talking about changes of about 10 ppm in CO2 over a few centuries. And to put that in some context, you know, we've had a CO2 rise of over 100 ppm in just the last century. So it's fast for a geologist. It's relatively actually slow and a small change, I'd say, compared to the anthropogenic influence of the present day. But when we saw some of these small rises in CO2 of about 10 ppm, we also saw that the carbon isotopes, which can fingerprint different sources of CO2, also changed quite rapidly, and they were changing in a direction that was saying that the CO2 might be coming from the land biosphere, and that would be things like land plants or carbon stored in soils.
Right. I'm thinking during the times when the glaciers were around, it was also pretty dry, was it not?
That's what you would say globally. Colder air can hold less water vapor. You know, this is just like in the wintertime, the air is drier and colder.
Plus, a lot of the world's available water got sucked up into the glaciers and stored there. So the reason I bring that up is because if, as the glaciers advance and that period advances, then land plants die, obviously. They're going to give up their carbon. There's a carbon balance happening there that I haven't totally grasped yet.
Yeah, so let's go back in time to the time when the ice sheets were big during the last glacial maximum, about 20,000 years ago. At that time, probably lots of carbon from land had been essentially scraped off the continents, let's say, and dumped into the ocean. Then as the ice sheets pulled back, you know, you can think of the boreal forest in Siberia or over Canada, eventually grew back and redeveloped soils. So on long time scales, you know, in and out of ice ages, you had this waxing and waning of carbon on land. But what was kind of interesting was that during the deglaciation, you might have had a little burp, essentially, of land carbon make its way to the atmosphere in a few centuries. And we looked at other climate records then to figure out where this land carbon could be coming from. And what we saw was at the time, there are records of climate from the tropics, from speleothems, essentially stalactites and stalagmites that grow in caves, can record how wet the cave system was and or how much rainfall there was over the tropics. We saw at that same time, the strength of the monsoons was very, very weak. So the possible idea is that there was maybe a cooling and widespread drought in the northern hemisphere, and that's what released a little bit of more CO2 to the atmosphere.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Thomas K. Bosca, a researcher at Cambridge University in the UK, We're talking about what we can learn and what we can't from new science on disappearing glaciers. Thomas, I know some listeners will be thinking, Greenland is melting rapidly now, parts of Antarctica are too, mountain glaciers all over the world are retreating. Are we not in a period of deglaciation now?
Yeah, that's an interesting way to think about it. One way to put it in context is that during the last ice age, we had a huge ice sheet that extended from essentially northern Canada all the way to Chicago, New York City, and that the total amount of more ice that was on the planet at that time was able to draw sea level down by about 120 meters or so. Now, in the future, we are looking at very significant rises in sea level, perhaps on the order of a meter over hundreds of years, but we won't be able to have the same magnitude change in sea level that we see on glacial interglacial cycles because there's just not as much ice left, essentially, on the planet compared to what there was in the Ice Age.
Okay, let's get right to your paper. What was your team trying to determine?
What we were trying to do was essentially fingerprint the sources for CO2 during the last deglaciation. So almost over 30 years ago, essentially in the 1980s, the first measurements from ice cores came out, and they pointed out that CO2 was probably lower during the last ice age. And over time, we refined the measurements, made better and better records of this rise in CO2. And it's been extremely important for understanding how the climate system works, because in order to predict the future, we have to have some understanding if the models are working, and a big target for models to see if they're getting their physics right and all and everything that goes into them is to study what the climate was like during the last ice age. And one really important thing to understand then is to how much lower CO2 was during the ice age.
How much lower was it?
CO2 during the last ice age was as low as 190 or so ppm. Now, to compare that, then, during the deglaciation, it rose about 80 ppm over at least 8,000 years. Now, to give that some context, though, we've already seen CO2 rise over 100 ppm over the last century. So it's a much slower change in CO2 than we're seeing today, but it's still an interesting time to understand how the Earth can transition from one climate to the next as CO2 changes.
How were your ice samples gathered, and what did you use to measure the state of CO2?
We actually found a fairly unique site to gather these ice samples. So probably your listeners are maybe familiar with ice cores and can imagine that generally we go to the very top of the ice sheet in Antarctica or Greenland and drill down to get older ice. But here we wanted to get very, very large samples of ice to measure gases that we can't get, because even in a deep ice core, the ice is very precious. So the other place, not only is there old ice deep in the ice sheets in Antarctica, but actually eventually that ice makes its way back to the surface, and most of it's lost in the form of icebergs, but some of it actually reaches the surface and outcrops on glaciers. So we went to this very special place called the Dry Valleys of Antarctica, and it's called the Dry Valleys because the conditions are very, very unique there, that as this ice flows out towards the sea, instead of melting or calving as iceberg, it actually sublimates, that is, you know, turns directly from a solid, essentially, to a vapor. So you have these large valleys in a few unique places in Antarctica that are free of ice, not because it's melting, but actually because it's sublimating. And so we went to this Taylor Glacier, and in this Dry Valleys, and actually found very old ice on the surface, and were able to essentially mine the ice and get almost unlimited sampling to take home back to the laboratory.
And then looking at the puzzles uncovered by this new research, your team attempted to come up with explanations, and most of those come from changes in the state of the ocean or ocean life. Can you talk a bit more about that, Thomas, please?
Yeah, there's a few hypotheses for what drives glacial and interglacial CO2. One of the things is that the theories behind glacial and interglacial CO2 are very, very diverse. And generally, what we think is that the ultimate drivers behind the CO2 rise are going to be complex, and they're actually going to be a combination of different things.
Let's go from that, because I think one of the things that I got from your email and from your paper is that you found a lot of possible pathways and drivers, and I think that's the most challenging part of your new science. You don't find a single mechanism to explain, but a very complex system that feeds back on itself, and that's part of the problem of communicating this science, would you say?
Yeah. I think the idea of feedbacks might be an interesting way to frame it. So essentially what we found during the deglaciation is that overall CO2 rises in two kind of distinct phases, and this is reflected in the carbon isotopes. So the earliest part of the CO2 rise, where it rose about 30 ppm over, let's say, 1,000 years, must have been sourced from organic matter that was in the deep ocean. Now, how this carbon got out of the ocean is still not known exactly. One theory is that the carbon was upwelled through stronger ocean currents. Possibly the driver of these ocean currents actually was the atmosphere. So around Antarctica, there's extremely strong current that surrounds the continent, and that's driven by winds. Now, one trigger for this CO2 increase could have been stronger winds, which then drove stronger upwelling, which then pulled carbon out of the deep ocean and brought it to the atmosphere. A kind of second idea is that maybe it's driven by changes in productivity. So the other thing, interesting thing about the ocean around Antarctica, this is called the Southern Ocean, is that the organisms that grow on the surface need iron to be productive. And at the same time of the initial CO2 rise, we also see a decrease in the flux of dust to Antarctica. And presumably, at the same time, the flux of iron that comes with this dust, terrestrial dust. So the other idea is that there was a decrease in dust to the Southern Ocean, a decrease in iron, and therefore a decrease in productivity, which had then allowed more CO2 to get out of the ocean and reach the atmosphere. Now, in the second phase of the CO2 rise, which occurs in the later part of the deglaciation, we see a different change in the carbon isotopes. And what possibly is going on there is that, well, we still probably have further release of CO2 from the oceans through biological processes, but the isotopes also tell us that ocean warming becomes more important for the CO2 rise in the latter half of the deglaciation. And that's kind of interesting, because that's saying there's a feedback there, where maybe the initial trigger for the rise was a change in ocean circulation, but then as more CO2 got in the atmosphere, it warmed the oceans, and that ocean warming then released more CO2, and when you add those things up, those feedbacks together can therefore drive a deglaciation.
You know, in our email exchange, you were discussing the importance of changes in ocean currents, and then you put the word climate in quotation marks, and that sent me off on a tangent wondering what we really mean by climate. We're talking about the deep relationship between the ocean, which is not part of the atmosphere, and what happens in the atmosphere. I think the public is confused about this as well. How do you define climate?
Well, a lot of times when we talk about abrupt climate change in the paleoclimate record, we're talking about rapid temperature changes in some regions, perhaps different things happening in other regions. And an example of this actually occurs during the deglaciation. So 14.6 thousand years ago or so, Greenland temperatures rapidly increased. Now, at the same time, we know from the ice cores in Antarctica, which we can synchronize with the ice cores in Greenland, that Antarctic temperature started to cool. So 14.6 or so thousand years ago was a period of an abrupt climate change. There wasn't at least a large global increase in temperatures. Rather, the northern hemisphere seemed to warm, while the southern hemisphere seemed to cool. And the leading hypothesis for this is that actually you're having a switch in ocean circulation, because the oceans can drive how heat is distributed between the hemispheres. So the idea actually is that 14.6 or so thousand years ago, essentially a conveyor in the ocean circulation system started to bring more heat and push it northward, which is why Greenland warmed, while at the same time it was stealing heat essentially from the southern hemisphere, and that's why Antarctica starts to cool.
Now, one caution I think that I've sensed from you is that some things that happened during deglaciation just don't apply to our situation today. Can you give us an example of a feedback or an event found in times when the great glaciers were melting that would not apply today?
Yeah, that's a good question. One example is we believe that some of these changes, these abrupt climate changes in the past in ocean circulation, were probably ultimately driven by a flux of fresh water into the ocean. In the case, the rather abrupt CO2 rise about 16.3 thousand years ago, where we think it could be driven by a release of land carbon, and we think that land carbon itself was driven by a cooling and perhaps drying of the northern tropics, the ultimate cause of that climate change, we don't really understand it, but actually the most interesting correlation we found and published on earlier was that this cooling and drying seems to occur when there was a Heinrich event. And a Heinrich event, Heinrich events are observed in the ocean sediments in the North Atlantic. And there are periods when you find sediment in the North Atlantic that you could only get if there were icebergs, large icebergs, being transported from far north into the very far south. So these Heinrich events are often thought of as these large iceberg armadas, essentially, being released from Hudson Strait, being released from the Laurentide ice sheet, which was the largest ice sheet during the last ice age. And that ice sheet is no longer there. So we think that it's unlikely that these kind of mechanisms can occur today because we just don't have the same ice sheet configuration, essentially. We don't have the large northern hemisphere ice sheets anymore.
And conversely, can you think of something from the period of deglaciation that would tell us something about what would happen in our future?
There could be two things. One thing I think the ice core records can possibly constrain is how sensitive land carbon is to climate change. So when climate modelers project how much CO2 is going to be in the atmosphere, say in 2100, the major determining factor is obviously how much fossil fuel we continue to burn. But there are some uncertainties in how much additional carbon come into the atmosphere, either from the land or from the ocean. So actually, when you try to project out temperatures for, say, the next 100 years or so, you have to take into account how the carbon system is going to respond to anthropogenic climate change. So one way to constrain that, then, is to look to the past when we have natural climate variability and possibly natural variability then in the carbon cycle in response to that climate forcing. So one idea is if we do see in the deglaciation that perhaps land carbon is sensitive to drought, for example, in the northern hemisphere, models that attempt to simulate the carbon cycle can use that as sort of a test bed to constrain their future projections, just to constrain sort of how sensitive the carbon cycle might be.
Well, climate sensitivity is a huge issue today, and it's something that definitely is not sorted out. What sort of research do you think needs to be done to take what you've been doing further?
I think one feature avenue for the deglaciation, as we've sort of been able to produce better and better data constraining the evolution of the climate and the carbon cycle across deglaciation, is to now take our best climate models and try to simulate these changes. Because it is possible that we can try to understand how sensitive the climate is by looking at these benchmarks in the past.
Okay, let's leave it there. From Britain, our patient guest has been scientist Thomas J. Boska. He's doing research into past ice ages at Cambridge University. He's the lead author of a paper titled Carbon Isotopes Characterize Rapid Changes in Atmospheric Carbon Dioxide During the Last Deglaciation. It was just published in PNAS. Find links for this paper and this discussion in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Thomas, thank you for helping us out.
Thank you.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.